Hello, I'm John Wilson. Thank you for downloading this edition of Master Tapes from BBC Radio 4. Welcome to Master Tapes and to Natalie Merchant playing live here at the BBC Maida Vale Studios. In this edition, I'll be taking Natalie back to the making of Tiger Lily, her 1995 debut solo album, recorded soon after she'd left the band 10,000 Maniacs. It included tracks such as Carnival, Beloved Wife and San Andreas Fault.
San Andreas Fault moved his fingers through the ground. Earth divided, place collided, such an awful sound. He was the love for certain of my life. For 50 years, simply my beloved wife. In that
Natalie Merchant, welcome to Master Tapes.
Thank you, John. It's a pleasure to be here.
Tiger Lily is a very delicate, sparse-sounding, beautiful record. Songs about people and places and love and loss and grief and hope. But first and foremost, I guess, it's a watershed record for you because it's the first solo record after you left 10,000 Maniacs. So is this the sound of artistic liberation, do you think?
I think it's the sound of terror at points, trepidation, fear, and a little bit of liberation.
And it's a band that lasted, what, 12 years?
12 years.
Six albums, great critical and commercial success. There's a story that when you first joined 10,000 Maniacs, you weren't looking to be a singer, you weren't part, they were already on stage, they were playing club gigs, and you got up on stage and you improvised a set of lyrics from a social studies science textbook.
That is correct. I was 16 years old, so we have to mention that.
So you had no lyrics in your head.
And I was just a country 16, not a city 16.
What was the book? Can you remember?
I had been to the Daughters of the American Revolution thrift store, and I think for a quarter I bought this 1940s social studies textbook.
So you had no songs already written, so you were looking at the first thing you had to hand. It was a textbook, and you were quoting directly from the text in the book?
There were drugs involved.
Okay.
That's the part of the story that people leave out. I was 16 and there were drugs involved. That was my audition.
Yeah.
They thought I was great.
Have you got any idea what it sounded like?
No, reindeer are the cattle of Lapland was the chorus.
Reindeer and the cattle of Lapland.
Mm-hmm. Okay. I remember the illustration very clearly. But I got the gig. 12 years.
But the band had huge international success. But were you a reluctant rock star?
I was 16 years old when I started. We signed our major label contract when I was 19. So I don't think there are a lot of extroverted, extremely self-confident girls at 16, 17, 18 years old, 19. I was 16, but most of the people in the band were 7 to 12 years older than I was. And they had more experience in life, especially John, the bass player, who was 12 years older than I was. And he said, you know what the best thing would be? You sing, don't talk. Keep yourself a mystery until you actually know what you have to say. That was good advice. So he actually was the spokesperson of the band in the beginning.
But the record company, I presume, increasingly wanted to put you center stage to make you the star of the band. I mean, at one point they were suggesting it was Natalie Merchant and the 10,000 Maniacs.
Yeah, I fought that. Yeah, I wanted to keep my name for myself.
But also you gave the band 2 years' notice that you were going to quit the band. A lot of artists citing creative differences, hating each other, they just split overnight. But you said, I'm going to give you two albums. Mm-hmm. It was almost like the 10,000 Maniacs pension plan, was it?
Well, the thing was that we had this long history together, and I definitely would never become a musician if I hadn't met them, and I felt I owed them a lot. A couple of the members had children. It would have been cruel to just keep it to myself and then one day just leave, and so I promised them another album, and actually we got two albums because we were asked to do an MTV Unplugged album.
Which is a big seller then, wasn't it?
Which did really well.
Had you already started writing the songs that worked their way onto Tiger Lily when you were with 10,000 Maniacs?
Or nope.
There was no overlap at all?
No.
You finished the band, and did you sit down to write an album straight away, or did it just evolve over a period of time?
Well, I had been writing, but none of the songs that I had written before I left the band actually have ever been recorded. I have pretty funny four-track cassette demos of a lot of those songs, and I actually have listened to them a little more than I have to Tiger Lily. I had not listened to Tiger Lily until two nights ago. I put it on, and it had been probably 15, 16 years since I'd heard it. And I was really shocked by how much I sounded like Minnie Mouse. My voice has changed so much.
There's a fragility to a lot of the songs as well. And it's a very stripped back album. And that's to do with the circumstances, because I think you'd been offered an advance from a record company to spend a lot of money to go into a studio with a producer. But instead, you put a band together.
Well, I didn't have a problem with being in a band. I liked being in a band. I just wanted to have more sovereignty as a writer, that they were my songs. It was my band.
And you went from being the youngest member of the group with 10,000
minutes
to the oldest. And you were in charge. You had to sort out everything. You had to book the musicians.
I became Mama Moneybags.
Right. And you put them up in your house.
Yeah.
So this is a very much the sound of a DIY recording on the record as well.
Well, that's how the Maniacs had begun too. It's very do-it-yourself. I say Mama Moneybags because Jennifer, who became my guitar player, called me Mama Moneybags.
She was young, wasn't she? You'd met
she
her.
Was. She was 22 when I met her, and she'd only been playing guitar, I think, for 2.5 years.
That's astonishing, because, I mean,
she's a phenomenal.
Incredible
musician.
Guitar player. Some of the licks on that album, some of the blues licks in particular, you get a real sense of a very experienced musician. But she's 22, she'd been playing for 2 years. She's a complete natural.
She was.
What was the first song that you wrote? Because you realise you have a project here, you have to put your own stamp on a record. And was it important that whatever the first song was would reflect something of the new situation, would be a statement of intent?
Yeah, even though people cannibalize records these days and listen to whatever they want and put them in random order, I still labor over sequence. I just thought that San Andreas Fault was the right song to start with.
And it's a song seemingly about the veneer of life in LA, about the young starlets arriving in town, wide-eyed with wonder, but the fault line, the earthquakes within the city itself being a great metaphor for the nonsense of that, of celebrity life. Had you been to L.A. and you didn't like the experience, or had you experienced...
I was held captive in L.A. for about 8 months working on In My Tribe. I had to be administered oxygen one day because I decided to foolishly walk to the studio from the apartment. There was a smog warning that day I wasn't aware of.
And the song suggests the whole facade could come crumbling down at any moment.
Well, I've been
moment.
In a couple of earthquakes while I was there. That's the chord. Okay, here we go. Should I just start with the verse since we already did the introduction? Okay.
Go west, paradise is there. You'll have all that you can eat, with milk and honey over there. You'll be the brightest star the world has ever seen. Sun-baked, slender heroine, a film and magazine. Your pale blue eyes, strawberry hair, lips so sweet, skin so fair, your future bright, beyond compare, it strikes to riches over there.
Is that a good enough example?
And that's the first song on the album, the opening track, but not the first song that you'd written. The first one you wrote was I May Know the Word.
I think it was, because when I first left the band, I moved. And I remember writing that song on my piano in a particular room, and that was that house.
I mean, it's a personal and reflective lyric in I May Know the Word, and possibly reflects something about the new solitary lifestyle that you're about to embark on.
You might think, but I don't.
That's not what the song's about, you mean?
Actually, I don't remember exact. There was no event that it was about, but I think it's more about introspection, that dark, ruminating introspection that happens in the middle of the night when you realize that there's something that you could have said, but you didn't say, or something you could have done, but you didn't do, and that probably would have been the better thing to do, but you're not a better person. You know, it was that kind of circular thought pattern. I think that's what this song is about. I should do it like this.
I may know the word, but not say it. I may know the truth, but not face it. Whisper. sacred hand fell. But turn my head indifferent. Well, I may know.
The sense that it's dark, you're alone,
yeah.
You're full of regret. That's the aim. That was the goal.
That was fantastic.
Oh, thank you.
I also got the sense of you working your way back into the song, in a way, learning the songs for the first time.
I haven't even heard this song. Until I was asked to do this program, yeah. I haven't even heard this song in 15 years, like I said.
And you very rarely, if ever, play the piano in public. I mean, you only use it as a tool in the studio. You never. It's the only instrument you play, but you never play in public.
No, I write and then I forget. I found people who play a lot better than me. Then I can just be in front of the, you know, musicians and sing and not have to be worried about hand configurations.
But what's interesting, sitting here alongside the keyboard with you and watching you feel your way back into the song, that I presume is very similar to the process of originally writing the song, mm-hmm. in your room when you were kind of matching the words to the melody, you're feeling your way around the keyboard.
Right.
Does it take you back to that place?
I remember a lot of things that happened in that house. I remember River and I were speaking on the phone in my kitchen, and then I did a publicity tour. I did the publicity tour, and then I went to Venice for a week by myself. But I remember coming home, I hadn't read a newspaper, hadn't heard the radio, I'd been in a country where I didn't really speak the language, and I had missed his death by 2 days. And I remember being in the kitchen in that house.
And this is the actor River Phoenix who... It's exactly, almost exactly 20 years ago.
October 31st.
He died. And so he was a close friend of yours.
We were becoming closer, which is a shame.
And so that must have been a terrible shock not to have known what had happened when it was going around the world. And you write a song in response to what happens in the wake of his death. Mm. And in a
well,
way...
then I did go see the newspaper. There were horrible things in the wake of his death.
And that's really interesting, the way that you respond to that song, because it's a very personal and tender song, which reflects on him as a person, but also there's a sense of anger in that song, which is quite unusual on this album. We only get it in fleeting moments when you rail against the media. You were really shocked about the way that they were looking at every aspect of...
Well, they published photographs of his dead body in a casket. That seems extremely invasive and disrespectful of anyone.
Was it a very difficult song to write? Did you feel you had to write it, or was it something that... It took a while to express.
No, it was one of those stay up all night and finish it kind of songs. Had to come out. And the chorus, let the youth of America come. I knew this was going to be tough. Let the youth of America come on. Include him in their praise. Let his image linger. Everywhere. So it went from extremely personal to sort of anthemic in a way, because he belonged to his family, his intimate circle, but he also from his work. And since he had been a child actor, people, because he grew up in the public eye, people felt a strong affection for him.
And you say it was an easy song in a way to write because it poured out of you. But 20 years on, it's very striking how it still moves you. I mean, it's very difficult for you to talk about it there at that moment. But it's easier to turn to the piano to express it in song. Has that always been the case with you? Has song always been your emotional outlet?
Yeah, my savior. There was a great quote from Nina Simone, if I hadn't been a singer, I would have been a murderess. And I think if I hadn't been a songwriter, I'd probably been very frustrated and wouldn't have had an outlet for those feelings. That's one of the things I write about and have written about for 30 years. Power, abuse of power.
And you've done that throughout your career. You've written about global events and things that are wrong in the world. But in this album, On Tiger Lily, is one of the most focused and personal songs I think you've probably ever written, and that's Beloved Wife. And the reason it's so affecting is because it's about your own grandparents.
It was my first experience with death when I was 19. I was extremely close to both my grandparents, and my grandmother had been in a coma, and my grandfather was so faithful, visited her every day, sat with her all day, every day, for 2 months. And then she passed, and he died 3 days later.
And you went to visit him, you went to see him before he died?
I did. I was with him when he had his heart attack. He was viewing her body.
And do you feel you express in that song, you ask that question on his behalf, you know, can I not go too?
It's really cheerful. Sorry.
It's part of the album, though. And that's important, isn't it? It's important that you can express it and use the album.
And now I do it with full orchestra, full orchestral arrangement. And it's so beautiful. And people are weeping in the audience. And I have to just keep my eyes shut because it's contagious.
You've sung it with the orchestra and you've got people around you. We're here with people around you, but you're sitting at the piano. It's a very exposed situation. Do you think you can play that song for us now?
I could try. I doubt I'll get through it, but I could try.
Well, the life is certain of my life. You were simply my beloved wife. I don't know for certain how I'll live my life. Now alone, without my beloved wife. My beloved wife.
As far as I can go safely.
Incredibly powerful song, and still very, very difficult for you to sing.
I feel waves, and it's not just within me. I feel waves come off the audience.
I think a lot of people in the audience seem to have something in their eye. So we'll move up. Possibly the best known track on the album is Carnival, And that, even though there's a real sort of rolling rhythm to that song, there's a kind of wide-eyed wonder in the imagery. It seems to be about walking through a city for the first time.
Manhattan.
It's about memories of walking through Manhattan for the first time.
It was about me trying to live in New York. I don't know who I was kidding, who I thought I was going to fool.
And it's about the sights and the sounds and the smells and just the visual assault of the place.
Overload. And the desensitization that happens to a lot of people that is the reason I couldn't live there. I couldn't desensitize myself. Couldn't walk past people eating garbage in rags without shoes. Couldn't do it.
And you say you're a country girl at heart and you've grown up outside the city and in the state of New York, in Jamestown, and stayed there. I mean, you studied there as well, didn't you? You grew up there.
Well, I spent my first 25 years there.
And growing up in Jamestown, what was upbringing like? Was it a musical household?
It was. I had young parents who listened to music all the time, and I inherited my mother's records when I was probably 7. And she had one of those plastic cylindrical carrying cases with a spindle up the middle that held her 45s so she could go to her friends' houses and listen to her favorite 45s. Grandma's going to tell you a story now about vinyl. But in that, she had Bob Dylan, Buddy Holly, and she had some pretty embarrassing stuff. And actually, I just found out that my great-grandmother, she and her 2 sisters started the very first all-women's band in America. I didn't know that until about 2 months ago.
Wow, what sort of band was that?
It was a municipal band during the First World War, 1916. And they played on the pier in Atlantic City. I have a postcard. My great-grandmother was the conductor, and my great-aunt was the clarinet player, and my other great-aunt was the drummer. They must have been filling in while the boys were overseas, I guess.
And you had no idea about that before?
No.
How did you stumble across that?
My aunt sent me a scan of the postcard. Said, now you tell me. All these years, do you come from a musical family? No, no history whatsoever. And then I had, on my Italian side, there was an opera singer 2 generations ago. And my grandfather was a piano tuner.
Was that your maternal grandparents or paternal?
Paternal.
Paternal. So that's the paternal grandparent came from Sicily.
From Sicily.
And he was Mercante originally.
Mercante.
And was he anglicized at Ellis Island then?
They were. They took the E off. Every year there's an Italian-American Association dinner in Washington, D.C. I get invited every year. I went 1 year. Tony Danza was sitting next to me. He goes, Nelly, what are you doing here? Your name ends in a consonant. And I went, Mercante. He went, scratch the surface. Get a whop.
You're going to play us out of this first part of the program with Wonder, which is a song which seems to be sung from the point of view of a child who has somehow defied medical science or is in some way blessed.
It was about a child who was born with a congenital disease.
An imagined child, or again, is this based on personal experience?
Personal experience.
Right.
I don't like to talk about it that much. I think I've put people through enough here today. It was actually 2 children. They were twins, and they had a horrendous congenital disease. But they were the most optimistic, bright, talented, beautiful people I've ever known. Their mother gave birth to them when she was 19, and she was told that you should institutionalize these girls. There's no way you can take care of them. And she took them home. And then they told her they won't live beyond 3 years, and they lived to 12. And they said, well, the life expectancy is 12. They died at 26.
And it's a song which later, I mean, as you've written about in the sleeve notes to one of the albums, you were presenting or accepting an award, I think, weren't you, at some kind of medical foundation?
I was giving an award.
You were giving an award.
To a research scientist. The physician who was accepting the award said that he, on numerous occasions, had seen the lyrics of my songs that the parents had put over the cribs of their babies.
What did you make of that when you heard that story?
I was really touched. This is a real sob fest. Can you talk about something funny?
Lift us up. Lift us up and play us out with the song.
Okay.
Because that is all we have time for in this first part of this edition of Master Tapes. My thanks to Natalie Merchant. In the second part of this edition, the B-side, we'll be hearing more about the making of Tiger Lily. We'll have more music from Natalie and we'll have questions from our studio audience. You can hear that tomorrow afternoon at 3:30 on Radio 4. This and previous editions are available to listen to and download via the Master Tapes pages at the Radio 4 website, where you can also see videos of some of the performances from the series. And you can tweet about the programme using the hashtag Master Tapes. But we leave you tonight with Natalie Merchant playing Wonder. Thank you.
in cities just to see me. Stand over my bed, disbelieving what they're seeing. They say I must be one of the wonders of God's own creation.
Remember, you can find the full version of this and other songs recorded during our live sessions on the Master Tapes pages at the Radio 4 website, along with photographs, videos, and the other editions of the series.
Second part of the programme, Natalie's going to be telling some jokes.
And talking in funny accents.
We need all of your funny accents. We got some in the sound check. The Catherine Hepburn was outstanding.
I'll be doing that as well.
It was one of the most heartbreaking editions of Master Tapes.
It was terrible. If Spencer was here, Spencer would say, Catherine.
Did you record those? Because we're just going to have to liberally drop them in that.
No, it's not possible.